And we're looking at the book of Acts, just looking at what the church did, what they looked like before it became this huge institution with a 2,000-year history. It's good to just get back and look at the roots of what this thing looked like. And we're going to be looking at chapter 4 this morning. And going through that, if you want to turn, if you have a Bible, you'd like to read along with me, you can turn to chapter 4. If you remember, we went through chapter 3, and that's where Peter and John were on their way to a prayer meeting at the temple. And on their way in, Peter was led by the Spirit just to command a lame man who was over 40 years old. Was probably a very familiar sight to people going to the temple if he was that old, been there for years, decades probably, asking people for donations. That was kind of the welfare system back in those days. And Peter saw him and he said, "Listen, we're just as broke as you are, but in the name of the Lord Jesus, stand up and walk." And he did. And the result of this supernatural intervention of God in this man's life was very similar to when God intervened back in the second chapter of Acts. There was a crowd that gathered, a large crowd gathered, and Peter, as his custom was, immediately took advantage of that crowd being gathered, and he began to explain the nature of this radical new spiritual revolution that was springing up in the midst of this Jewish community, that this Jesus of Nazareth was indeed the Jewish Messiah. Even though he was executed and put to death, he's now proclaiming that he has risen from the dead, that he's still the Messiah. And though maybe you thought he was like dozens of others, because it was very common in first century Judaism for various rabbis to rise up and then be proclaiming that they were the Messiah, and then something would happen, they would get killed, and that movement was over, and they would move on to the next one. Well, this looked like it was going to be the same type of thing, this peasant revolutionary from Nazareth, but yet the movement actually has gained steam, even though he was executed and killed, and they're claiming that he's alive again. And that's kind of a crazy thing to claim, and it's probably kind of tough to get people to believe that. As a matter of fact, in the natural, it's impossible to get people to believe that unless there's actual evidence of it. And we talked about the evidence of that last week, but here, God verifies the power of God to sometimes intervene within our natural physical circumstances where things have a certain order and the way they take place. And God occasionally will intervene within the natural process of things from the supernatural realm and cause what we call a miracle to happen. And that's what happened here. And Peter is explaining to them that, see, the same power that rose Jesus from the dead has worked in this guy, that he's able to rise up and stand for the first time in his life. The Bible says that he was lame from birth. He was born crippled. And as a matter of fact, why Peter begins to explain this stuff to him, in the 11th verse of the third chapter, it says that this guy is literally clinging to Peter. So it's like, here's the evidence right here clinging to me that this stuff is real. You've seen this guy. He's been asking you for money for the last 30 years. Look at him. He's standing. He's clinging to me. Now let me explain to you what the deal is on this. And he begins to explain and he preaches to them. And then at the end of his sermon, we see that something else happens. But basically, what this is right now is this is a major move of God that's taken place. There were centuries between the last book of the Old Testament and the coming of Jesus. And it's kind of looked at as that it was sort of a dead spiritual time. There wasn't a whole lot going on. There were some rebellions that happened and some wars that took place. But for the most part, God was kind of silent. And now all of a sudden, All this stuff is taking place. People that had just read about the miraculous workings of God, when they heard stories about Moses and how God parted the Red Sea, all of a sudden they're starting to see supernatural events happen again. And here's one right in front of them. This crippled guy is standing in front of them. So this is a serious spiritual movement that is rising up right within their midst. I guess a word that we would often use today for this same type of thing is revival. The only thing is that word's kind of been overused and maybe lost its original meaning. Back in the day when you hear the word revival, you might think that it just means a set of religious meetings. You know, evangelists would come to town, they'd set up a tent, or maybe a church would have a special time of meetings, and they'd put out a sign and it would say revival, July 5th to July 10th. But you know what? If a genuine biblical revival is taking place, you won't need a sign. I mean, they didn't need a sign here. God's got his own signs and miraculous wonders taking place here. Revival. Let's just look at the word for a second. I looked at it. It's kind of interesting. In the middle of that word is V-I-V, vive or viv. And that word actually relates to life. If you look at, I remember we used to go to a restaurant, Viva Loco. And I think that means something like, has to do with life, like crazy life or live crazy. So even in the Spanish language, I know we got Spanish people there. Is he doing it right? Yeah, he's like, am I okay on that? Okay. V-I-V-I-R, that's live. It has to do with life. And even in the English language, V-I-V has to do with life, like vivid, right? V-I-V, vivid. That means full of life or vivacious. That's a person who's energetic and full of life. So V-I-V is right in the middle of revival. So it has to do with life. It's got to be a life-related word. Now we got R-E on the front of that word. Whenever you put R-E in front of a word, that usually means again, right? We're going to do it again. If we review, then we're going to view it again, right? If we're going to group, and then we're going to regroup, or we're going to come together again. If a person faints, we hope she or quickly could be revived, right? Bring life back to them again, hopefully quickly. Have you ever had that happen? That's a weird thing when you faint, isn't it? It only happened to me once. I remember I started feeling, I was about maybe 12 years old, and I started feeling dizzy all of a sudden. I didn't know what was going on, and I walked out in the hallway to tell my mom, and the next thing I know, I got all these people looking over me, and like it seemed like it was a dream, you know? It was weird. And they said, yeah, what did you want to tell us? You came out in the hallway, and you're like, Mom, and I fell down, you know? But that's when that happens, it kind of freaks you out, and the other people, and they want to bring life back to you again as quick as possible. Then we got AL on the end of it. So we got re and vive. Now we got AL. That usually has to do with means to pertaining to the beginning or pertaining to something or having to do with something else, pertaining to something else, like survive, and you put AL on it, has to do with the act of survive. So the word revive is literally that which pertains to life coming back again. That which pertains to life coming back again. So in the spiritual, we're talking about spiritual life coming back in again. In this case, into the Jewish community. Something is springing up, man. There's spiritual life coming back up within Israel after centuries of silence. So I want to look at some of the distinct traits of revival, because we have one right here. Here it is, before it got dragged through the mud, and it was something that we have all these other stereotypical ideas when we think of revival. Here's the original one right here, and it's in Israel. Bunch of Jewish people having a revival, a Christian revival. How do you like that? That's where it all started. Here it is, right here in chapter 4. So we're going to look at some of the distinct traits. These aren't all of them, certainly. I'm just going to do probably just a couple of them this morning, but a couple that I see here that are certainly worth our recognition and looking at. So let's, first four verses of chapter 4, let's see what the first trait, distinct trait of genuine revival is. Verse 1, chapter 4, as they were speaking to the people, John and Peter, I told you he spoke to them after they saw this miracle take place, the priests and the captain of the temple guard and the Sadducees came to them, being greatly disturbed because they were teaching the people and proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead. And it looked like a cult to them. What are these guys doing here? They're raising up people, getting off track here, a whole new religion they're creating. They're upset about it. So they come in there, and what do? First, verse 3, and they laid hands on them and put them in jail until the next day, for it was already evening. Just to remind you that it's a serious revival going on at the same time in the midst of this, verse 4 says, but many of those who had heard the message believed, and the number of the men came to be about 5,000. So that's serious revival there. But what do we see right along with it? Adversity. It's a twin of revival. Whether God is reviving something in you personally or as a group in a community, it just goes with the territory. You know, Jesus said when he referred to who is the ruler of this world or the prince of this world, he didn't say it was him. He didn't say it was his father. When he used that title, he often connected it to the devil himself. So, as I often say, we're operating, according to the Bible, in many respects, in enemy-occupied territory. Which means if God is gaining ground, if something of real spiritual life is springing up within the midst of what Jesus said was, for the most part, enemy-occupied territory, it's not always going to elicit a friendly response. It's just the way it is. As a matter of fact, Jesus said, it's not necessarily a good sign when everybody's talking well of you if you're doing God's work. That's a hard one to swallow for guys like me that just want everybody to love them. You know, you want everybody to like you. Hate to have anybody mad at you. But Jesus said in Luke 6:26, woe to you when all men speak well of you. That stinks, doesn't it? Man, because I want you all to talk good about me, you know? But be careful, for their fathers used to treat the false prophets in the same way. Again, that's just not an easy verse. I remember reading about Rich Mullins says, well, that's why God allowed man to invent highlighters, so we can just highlight the parts of the Bible that we like, and then we can ignore the other parts that we don't really want. I didn't highlight that one, you know? Speaking the truth, God's truth, is not always an easy thing in this world. It's very intimidating. You ever think about that? Why am I so intimidated to speak God's truth? I don't think it's just because, you know, people are going to maybe think I think there's a spiritual element in there. I mean, you read some of the ballistic stuff that people have no problem putting on their bumpers or wearing on their t-shirts, and yet we're so intimidated to put anything on there or anything on our shirt that maybe has something to say about Jesus. I mean, God's already, but then you go to Jesus, that's like the next level, you know? I mean, nobody wants to go there. The thing is that we don't just speak truth, the Bible informs us, but that we have to speak truth in love. Now, that sounds good. You figure, well, if I can speak truth in love, then I ought to be all right. You see, the problem is you see it being done by Jesus. I mean, nobody's going to speak truth better in love than Jesus, and it got him up on a cross. He ended up getting put to death. His followers are doing it right here. They end up in jail. So sometimes it doesn't always work. Now, there's plenty of people maybe just speaking truth, and there's plenty of other people just speaking stuff in love. You got activist groups that love to just speak truth. And they bring down the hammer, and they're denouncing anybody that's against them, and people love it that are on their side, and they're right there behind them. You know, yeah, tell the truth. You know, never mind about love. Just tell them the truth. And you got plenty of other groups that aren't necessarily so concerned about truth. They just speak everything in love. You know, I love you, you love me, we're one happy family. You know, everything's love, and there's not necessarily a whole lot of truth going on. But Jesus said that he and his followers, the Bible says that we have to put truth and love together. And the interesting thing is, even though you put them both together, still people will get upset. They got upset here in the Bible. One of the traits of the gospel is when it's not tampered with. Just pure, unadulterated gospel. It's a perfect balance of truth and love. One of the best ways I've ever heard it put is that it afflicts the comfortable and it comforts the afflicted. Which I don't really like either, because I fit in the comfortable category, you know. Just ordered a new bed yesterday. The other was about 15 years old, you know. That's how we do it here in America. 15 years old. Oh, man, you're supposed to get a new one every 10 years. I think it's a healthy thing for people like me that tend to be a little too comfortable to have to just go back and reread some of the stuff I didn't highlight. I like how Mark Twain put it. He says, you know, a lot of people, they just like, I don't understand that. I mean, what did Jesus mean? You know, or some of the stuff in the Old Testament, what the heck does that mean? And Mark Twain says, you know what? It's not the stuff that I don't understand that bothers me in the Bible. It's the stuff I do understand. I mean, maybe like even at the end of this end of this chapter here, very end of chapter 4 here, Luke recorded this, verse 34. It says, for there was not a needy person among them. That's fantastic. That's what I want a congregation where there's not one needy person among them. I wonder how he did that. You know, I mean, with Peter, it was pretty cool, wasn't it? Peter, Jesus said, yeah, just go get that fish. And he got the fish, and there it was, man, a gold coin right in the mouth. You know, so there's no need in the congregation. When we have a need, I'll just tell you to go fish. You know, trust the Lord. Come on, where's your faith? There's another kind of faith going on here. For there was not a needy person among them. I highlighted that. Next part of that line, for all who were owners of land or houses would sell them and bring the proceeds of the sales and lay them at the apostles' feet, and they would be distributed to each as any had need. Put my highlighter away at that point. Man, what is up with that? You know, I remember once, I think it was Campolo again, he was at some fundraising event, and they needed money for some missions project, and somebody said, you know, we need to just really pray that God's going to provide. You know, would you mind leading us in prayer that God is just going to provide for this missions project? And he says, well, before we do that, he says, God's already given me something. He takes out his wallet and he says, look at this. I still got 40 bucks in my wallet. Here's my 40 bucks. What do you got left in yours? Whoops. They went through. Everybody laid down what they had. By the time they were done, they had exactly what they needed. He says, see that? We were going to go pray and ask God to provide when he had already given it to us. Wow. But I think I'll just leave that there. Maybe we'll talk more about that next week. I'm thinking about having a guest speaker come in or something. You know what? Jesus said, in this world, you'll just have tribulation. It's the way it is. He didn't say you might. He didn't say there's a good chance. He said you will. You will have tribulation. So don't start going down this path like, you know, you find yourself in this condition or that circumstance and start to talk about how maybe God's forgotten about you. If everything's going smooth, that's when you need to worry a little bit. When you're following Jesus, you will have tribulation. I'm glad he didn't just stop there, though, you know, just leave it flat. He went on, he said, but take courage. I've overcome the world. Revival's exciting, but it's not always a safe or comfortable thing when it's the real deal, because one of its byproducts is affliction, persecution. So just beware. Next trait, another distinct trait I see, is in verses 13 through 16. Let's just read those. Now I talk about a little bit. Now, as they observed the confidence of Peter and John and understood that they were uneducated and untrained men, they were amazed and began to recognize them as having been with Jesus. And seeing the man who had been healed standing with them, they had nothing to say in reply. But when they had ordered them to leave the council, they began to confer with one another, saying, what shall we do with these men? For the fact that a noteworthy miracle has taken place through them is apparent to all who live in Jerusalem. We're not going to be able to deny that. When genuine revival hits, there is undeniable evidence of God's work. There's undeniable fingerprints of that are often just impossible to explain without a supernatural explanation, that there's got to be another dimension that's affecting circumstances and what's happening here. It becomes undeniable. These uneducated fishermen were speaking with such articulate wisdom that it was obvious to these guys that this Jesus was more than just this peasant revolutionary that they were trying to write him off as. There must be something going on here. The fact that he mentored these guys for 3 years, look at the way they're speaking. Look at the power they have here. And I just love the way Luke puts, you know, the narration here and talks about it. And just said, these guys, they saw the man who had been healed standing with them. I mean, what do you say? You know, it's no longer just a theological apologetic debate anymore when you've got a bona fide miracle standing there right with them. What are we going to say is basically, you know, was there, they just didn't even know how to reply. The thing is that we're not just looking, God is not just looking to demonstrate his power here, but he's looking to demonstrate his love. I think it's amazing, you know, it's just something that I realized, always just kind of take for granted the fact that when God demonstrates his power through the Messiah, it's usually demonstrated by alleviating human suffering. I mean, do you ever think about that? He could certainly, if it was just about demonstrating his power, as plenty of other things he could have done that he had done in the past. I mean, he could have just split the Red Sea without a whole horde of Israelites in desperate need to escape. He could have just split it and said, listen, here's how powerful I am. Watch this one. Pretty good, huh? I mean, you know, do some kind of crazy thing in the sky and spell out his name, or just have a flash of fire up here. He could do any of that things, but out of all the things that he could have done, he demonstrates most of the time his power through alleviating human suffering, because he doesn't just want to reveal how powerful he is, he wants to reveal his character. And his character is, he cares about you. He's absolutely crazy about you. And he'll do whatever it takes to win your heart over to him. Sometimes it's alleviating a suffering condition. Sometimes it's putting you in a suffering condition. And it's just amazing here. I kind of just looked at it. I Googled in the miracles of Jesus, and about 37 of them came up. And I counted 31 out of the 37 miracles were all alleviating human suffering conditions. I mean, that's a 5 out of every 6 miracles he did was to alleviate human suffering. That's a pretty good thing. I mean, the first one was, I wasn't sure how to count that one, whether that was alleviating human suffering or not, you know, changing the water into wine. I mean, you get some barrels of wine, man, it could alleviate some suffering, but you're going to need some prayer the next morning, you know, depending how you handle that whole thing. But, I mean, look at all these other healing of the royal official son, healing a man possessed by a demon in Capernaum, healing of Simon Peter's mother-in-law, healing the sick during the evening, healing a leper, healing a centurion servant, healing a paralyzed man, healing a withered hand, raising a widow's son, feeding 5,000 men that were hungry along with their families, another time 4,000 people, a blind man in Bethesda. The list just goes on and on and on and on and on, bringing Lazarus back to death. And I know I wear this out, but let me just say it one more time. It's just so important to remember that alleviating the human suffering is not the goal, it's the means. I mean, I always say, those 5,000 men and their family, they were hungry again the next morning. Jairus' daughter, Lazarus, the widow's child, they're dead. I mean, all those people that got healed, they got sick again and they died. So it's obviously not the goal. The goal is to draw us to the Father. To draw us to the Father. That's something that we're looking at in our small group. We're doing this thing on the prodigal son. And fascinating, because it was never called the prodigal son. Jesus never called it that. He called it the story of two sons. But one of the points hammered in that is that Jesus is showing us that he wants us to want the Father and not the Father's things. And both these sons wanted the Father's things. That's all they were interested in. You know, give me my inheritance. Which you usually don't get unless your dad dies, you know? So that's kind of a nice thing, you know? I remember once my dad was a shop teacher, man. He had all these tools. I mean, he had the German thing going on too, so they're all like in perfect order, size and everything, you know? And he says, you know what, Greg, one day, these tools, you could have them. I have his tools now. I'd rather not. Jesus has got all this tools and things for us. But it's not the focus. You look and I'm thinking, well, what does that mean? We talked about this Friday. What does that mean to just want the Father then? How do I just want the Father, not the Father's things? I mean, that's kind of tough, you know? But you look at people like these disciples or Paul. I mean, from the outside, you look at Paul's life, it's a disaster. I mean, all the whippings and the beating with rods and out on the sea for a day after a shipwreck, and the list just goes on and on and on. But you know what? He tasted and saw that the Lord was good. Have you ever? That's the whole thing, people. I'm telling you right now. all this teaching, all this other stuff, if you really want to understand what this is all about, you've got to taste. It's one encounter with God changes everything. You ever have, like I was saying on the other night, just one little microcosmic glimpse of God. You know, like, I don't know, maybe you were in a prayer meeting and something just starts to shift, man. And you can't explain it, but there's something spiritual going down, or you're worshiping, or something happens and you feel and experience the presence of God. And you're just like, this is it, man. This is it. All the other stuff doesn't matter. It really doesn't. You know, and you want to stay there, you know, sort of like the Peter, James, and John, you know, it's like, let's stay here, let's build. And Jesus said, no, we got to go back down the mountain. And then when you go back down, you're trying to remember how you felt, and it's tough, you know. You got to walk it out, but you get a taste. I remember Charles Schmidt saying, because, you know, these people have been in ministry for close to 60 years now, so they go back, they've got some amazing experiences. He, you know, talks about some of the things that happened back in the 50s, and Dottie Schmidt got to see A.W. Tozer preach in Manhattan and things like that. And Charles Schmidt said, listen, I know, hopefully most of you know what I mean, but just in case, let me tell you this. When you really experience genuine revival, spiritual life being infused to you, even if it's just for a second, you're ruined for life. Yeah, that's right. It's like, man, this is it. This is it. Jesus, if it means to heal a lame man that's been there for 40 years, then he'll do it. But that's not it, man. The Father is what's it. And if you're just not into it, then you need to experience the Father. And we all have different pathways and different personalities. Some people's pathway is they're just studiers, man. And they just, as they're studying the Word, they feel God's presence. Other people have musical gifts. And while they're worshiping God, that's how they experience His presence. And that's where it's at. By the way, did you enjoy the family reunion up here this morning? That was Joel's sister, by the way, and his brother-in-law. It's trying to get them to move up here, I see. All right, we'll pray about that. Anyway, to draw us to the Father, not the Father's sake. Maybe that's why he seems to be more drawn to people directly to himself. You know, often he just draws people directly to himself without even using the special effects department, you know? I mean, I love the special effects department. I love when God does something really cool, you know? I mean, really heal somebody, you know? I mean, that's awesome. I love reading about this stuff. But I think it's amazing sometimes when he doesn't even do that. I think most of us heard this week about the tragedy with David Wilkerson. I would say, next to the Bible, one of the most influential books that I ever read, especially when I first became a Christian, as I think it is with a lot of people, was David Wilkerson's testimony, just entitled A Cross in the Switchblade. And the fact that he was 79, can you imagine making it to 79, and you end up dying in a car accident? I mean, it wasn't even old age. I kind of look at that as God's mercy. You know, I mean, I'll tell you what, I go visit people in their late 90s. Getting old ain't for sissies, man. I mean, you're waking up every day. Catherine Linton, she can't walk. She's in pain every day. Man, when you see that, sometimes a head-on collision where it's just instant, driving your car, next thing you know, you're in heaven. You know, it doesn't look too bad sometimes. God knows what he's doing. But I was just kind of thinking about Wilkerson and his ministry, and I started thinking, you know what? What a great example of God's moving. Here's the man where this ministry of Teen Challenge began, where literally tens of thousands of drug addicts and alcoholics have been set free. And just think how crowded the jails are already. You have any idea how much more crowded they would have been if we didn't have Teen Challenge? I mean, when you think about what ministry does, it boggles the mind. When he went, and this was just a backwoods preacher in the mountains of Pennsylvania, and he felt through a set of circumstances, which I won't go into, but it's just amazing supernatural intervention that he felt to go from the mountains of Pennsylvania to the inner city slums of New York City. And eventually he called, he put together a revival meeting. They called them that back in the late 50s, you know. But this meeting was with gang members only. He had them bust in. I mean, police thought he was a nut job, as they probably would today if some preacher, especially from the country, came in and said, "Yeah, I'm going to have a, revival meeting with the Bloods tonight over at, you know." And it was no joke back then either, man. I mean, this is when West Side Story was going on. One of the things that burdened his heart is he saw that a handicapped kid in a wheelchair was brutally stabbed to death multiple times by a gang. Instead of getting angry and just building more jails and buying more ammunition and guns, he started praying. And he went into the city, he called this meeting, and he's got an auditorium full of gang members. He actually got them there, they provided buses. I mean, even that was a miracle that somehow he got them in the auditorium. He'd been working with them relationally, but still they came, and there it is. He's finally there. He comes behind the pulpit, and here's what he put in his book. "I began to speak, my heart beating high with hope. But if I thought I had won the sympathy of that crowd for my message, I was sorely mistaken. I had gotten their ears, but I couldn't seem to get near their hearts. I couldn't understand what was wrong with my sermon." Yeah, that's what we preachers do. We think it's a sermon. You know, I mean, that's our problem is we get more caught up in the preparation than the prayer. He says, "I'd done everything I could to make it a good sermon. I spent hours preparing it, and I prayed over every line of it. I'd even fasted and hoped that this would strengthen my delivery and my persuasiveness. But I might as well have stood up and read the stock market report. Nothing I said seemed real to these kids. Nothing came through to them. I preached for perhaps 15 minutes, and all I could sense was a growing restlessness in the crowd." Then he reached a point where he quoted Jesus' saying, "Love one another," to the gang members. One guy gets up, "Love one another. You want me to love these guys? That guy over there sliced me with a razor 2 months ago." Another guy gets up and pulls off his shirt and shows a bullet hole in his chest. It's like they're playing Top It with gang members, you know? And it's getting weird. I mean, you know, any minute the whole thing could just explode into a rumble. And they're saying, you know, "How in the heck am I going to love one another?" And he just said, "We don't have it. We have to ask him for it. There's very little we can do." And he realized he was probably speaking more to himself. So he just started praying. He stopped preaching and started praying. And a silence came over the auditorium. He said, "It seemed like the longest 3 minutes of my life." In the midst of the silence, supernatural intervention starts to take place. And the greatest miracle and sign that I believe of the Holy Spirit began to take place right then and there in the auditorium. Now, you're probably wondering what that is. Maybe you thought there was a lame kid that stood up and walked. Maybe somebody started speaking in tongues. You know what one of the most distinct signs is when the Holy Spirit begins to move? Tears and mucus. He started hearing the gang members. Some of them were starting to break. He stayed quiet a little longer, and then he just said, "All right. You felt him. He's here. He's in this room. He's come especially for you. If you want your life changed now, and it's time to come forward." And like, I mean, what's good about his book is he doesn't evangelistic, man, you know? I mean, it's a whole auditorium. Like 30 of them came up. But it's 30. It's like a gang. All right, there's another whatever, 200 there, 100. But 30 came up. And the supernatural intervention of God came into their life. He gave them Bibles. He talked to them. Made plans to see him the next day. The next morning, he gets a call from the police precinct asking him if he's familiar with some certain gang. And he's like, oh, you know, now what happened? You know, you have this, right? Here's the affliction. Here comes the persecution. We had the great day, and now they're right back at it the next morning. Police asked him if he could come down to the precinct. So he gets ready. He heads down to the precinct, and he goes into the precinct, and the police officer goes, "You're the pastor? Did this whole thing last night?" And he's a little hesitant. We say, "Yeah." "I want to shake your hand." You know what? Just six of them, I think it was, that went into the precinct. You know what they did? Just sort of like having fun. They went in to ask the police officers to autograph their Bibles. That's pretty cool, isn't it? You know, I mean, Luke said they had nothing to say in reply. I guarantee you these guys didn't, man. And they had nothing to say in reply. We think it's only in here, folks. It's happening. Who's got faith? Who's got enough spine to step up? I got to find some guy in the mountains of Pennsylvania. He's going to give it a shot, man. Who wants to step out? God. Hey, how about a Mother Teresa that goes out and throws her life away from the poorest of the poor? Nobody can give her anything back in total. Her whole life sacrificed to people who can give her nothing in return. And we all stand there and we've got nothing to say in reply except one person. I heard about one person that went, saw the whole ministry that she did, and they had a reply. They said, "Well, man, looking at cut of the disease. I mean, they can't even save lives. They're just trying to create circumstances where they could die comfortably." And he says, "Phew, I wouldn't do this for $1 million. And Mother Teresa said, "Neither would I." I don't know if she ever made any money. But she had the Father. She had fellowship with the Father. That's the church, people. That's the thing that Jesus said, "I'm going to put together, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." You know, we think about the gates of hell, and I think like, well, how do the gates come against the church? They don't. Gates were not for offensive purposes. They were defensive. They were right in the walls of the city. They kept people from being able to come in. So Jesus is saying, you know what? I'm not saying the church is going to have this great wall of protection around them, that the gates of hell or somebody how are going to come against it and it won't be able to prevail. He's saying, guess what? I'm calling the church to be offensive. I'm calling the church to go out and prevail against the gates. Even the gates aren't going to keep you from going in and snatching people out of hell. That's what Wilkerson did. And that's what Jesus did. That's what this whole thing is about. Humanity trapped in the mindset of self-centeredness. We can't even solve starvation. I saw a stat. You know how much it would cost to get rid of starvation? $20 billion to set it in motion. That's what Americans spend on ice cream in 1 year. Sin and the fallen condition of man is proven every day. And we love to look at everybody else. But it starts right here with me. I always say the best essay I ever saw written, when the London Times back in the early 1900s said, write a survey to some of the most popular, profound writers at the time, write an essay, what's wrong with the world? And G.K. Chesterton wrote it. What is wrong with the world? I am. We didn't necessarily get ourselves into this condition, so we can't get ourselves out of this condition. Someone else has to. This wonderful gift of the free will of man to choose what he wants to do, and the Lord said, you can have everything I've given you. See all this stuff, it's all yours. Just stay away from that one thing. And that was the one time they chose that they thought God was holding out on them. We always think God's holding out on us. We want this thing and the other thing, and he says to give away that and give away this, and that just doesn't make sense. But do we trust him? Do we think he really knows what's best for us? Or we think he's holding out on us. He thought they were holding out, and they did the very thing that he asked them not to do, and this infection came into all of humanity. You think HIV is a problem? I got a bigger one for you. There's not one person that doesn't have the infection. Self-centeredness, sin, the inability to love other people as much as I love myself. And the wages of this is sin, which creates death. But Jesus, who was without sin, paid it in our place, his body broken in place of mine. He said, whenever you do this, you need to do it and remember what I did. I did what you couldn't do, right through the gates of hell, prevailing, rescuing humanity out of the snatch of its own self-centered clutches. I no longer have to worry about what I do in order to get there, because it's not about what I do, it's about what he's done. What a relief that is, huh? His blood shed for you, his body broken for you. Why don't we wait until...